You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Daniel.
Hello, Bob. Good to see you.
Good to see you. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter, to which everyone should subscribe. This is the Non-Zero Podcast, which everyone should rate and review. And you are Daniel Levy, an old friend of mine, first of all. This is not our first conversation and not our first online video conversation. We were trying to remember we'll get to that later, but you've 18 years ago or so, probably. Anyway, you are president of the U.S. Middle East Project. You have also in the past served as an advisor to the Israeli government. You were on the negotiating team for the peace talks under Rabin, I guess, in the 90s, and then again under Prime Minister Barak in around 2001, the Taba talks.
Yep.
And you've been active since then. Now, you are not in Israel at the moment, but you're much more in touch than I am with events inside Israel and people inside Israel. So I was hoping to get some insights from you on the current conflict in the Middle East, which you may have heard about. Let me start with a mundane question, Daniel. I have heard that Israel this time, compared to, say, the 12-day war in June, is clamping down a little more tightly on images coming out of Israel. I don't know if that's true. I wouldn't think it's very easy to do, given social media and everything. But I've heard some people claim that that's the reason. We're not seeing a lot of damage being done to Israel. On the other hand, I'm also hearing that there are fewer missile launches from Iran. Do you have a sense for what the story is in that regard?
Yeah. Can I just start, Bob, by commending you on your most recent piece about the war and the outcome one should want to see?
That is the one permissible reason for interrupting me. Yes,
you've found
the magic.
I imagine your viewership is familiar with it, but if anyone isn't, then please look it up
It's on a Non-Zero Newsletter, and it has the title, The Possibly Regrettable Tire. We'll see how the blowback accumulates, but why Americans should root for Iran. Yes.
Yeah, I chose not to repeat the title.
Minimize the blowback. Yeah.
Or make sure the blowback stays on you. Let me try and answer your question. I think we saw a similar level of censorship in June. June, we're already, of course, longer into this, and it's a different order of magnitude, what is going on now than what happened in June.
In the Middle East broadly, you mean not you're not talking about the damage accumulating inside Israel? Or are you?
I think the extent of what's going on Israel-Iran is also, also, if you, as we can see, if it's Israel on its own, as it was in June, until the very brief American intervention, so-called midnight hammer, if it's Israel on its own against Iran, then it looks very different to when Israel can be in the slipstream, to speak, of the US. And therefore, Iran did not see June as either carrying the level of threat that this does, or as something that needed to be responded to in a way that seeks to establish a whole different deterrence equation and a whole different cost. And so this is, we're in different terrain here. Now, when it comes to questions of what has been hit, how intense the hits, getting out footage from the hits, the sensor works pretty well in Israel. So, first of all, there is that factor. In the US, what you have is an administration kind of threatening the media and a president that appears now regularly railing and flailing and ranting against the media, and looks like he's going to set his FCC commissioner onto the media. That's what they seem to be threatening. In Israel, it works a bit differently, which is the censorship is internalized and largely plays part of the role of that mobilized society, right? So Israeli Jewish society, I just draw that distinction, Zionist society between that and the 20% of the population of a Palestinian Arab, is very significantly on board with the war and sees it as its national duty to adhere to these restrictions. And that 20% of the population or those from within the non-Zionist community who are not on board with this are also pretty intimidated by now. And they know that they'll be the ones who are come after, who are gone after by the regime, by the establishment there. Alongside that, I don't want what I've just said to imply that I think there is a huge level of destruction, which if we peeled back the censor, we would see was the case. I don't think that is the case. I think there have been several rounds of rumors as to people or things that may have been hit. Those have been inaccurate, sometimes wildly exaggerated. And let's understand that. So what is going on inside Israel? It isn't that Israel has taken no hit. It isn't that Israel has taken a massive hit. It's that Iran has been able to send Israelis into the shelters, into their protected spaces. So either in most buildings, you'll either have a shelter or in the particular residence, a so-called protected room. That's less prevalent in the non-Jewish areas of the country. Not prevalent at all, of course, for Palestinians in the occupied territories. That's largely shut down the economy. In a small part of Israel, they've tried to partially reopen schools and certain workplaces. That's limited geographically and limited in terms of how far people are actually going along with that. But I think what we have to understand is the approach that Iran has taken in responding to this Israeli-American illegal aggression is to say, well, where we cause damage and where we demonstrate a capacity to hurt American interests and to cause chaos is not primarily inside Israel. So, of course, Iran is not going to desist from responding in Israel, and I think it will continue to respond in Israel, and it is therefore testing Israeli resilience. But the asymmetrical horizontal escalation of Iran is not to go toe-to-toe with American or Israeli forces. It's to challenge them in other spaces, which is why we see the Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz, etc., coming into play. Another thing that's going on here is that Iran is, and I think many people have commented on this, one of the main military aspects of this war is that race. On the Israeli-American side, can they destroy Iran's missile launching capacity? On the Iranian side, can they deplete Israeli-American interceptor capacity? And in that respect, I think the reports that Israel is running out of interceptors are credible. We know that America has transferred a lot of that capacity to the region, to Israel. We know that Israel didn't launch this war until the USS Gerald Ford was parked off the coast of Israel. So I think the absolute Israeli need for American protection is also being very much brought to the fore.
Okay. So let me say one thing about the Iranian strategy, partly because you made me self-conscious about the title of that piece I wrote for the Non-Zero newsletter. This is part of the breadth of the Iranian response, putting pressure on all these Gulf states, attacking them and noting that just about all of them have American bases in them. And that's the grounds for attacking them, according to Iran. And more broadly, just trying to constrict the supply of oil and other things coming out of the Middle East. That is, on the one hand, a strategy for putting America in the mood to end the war. But it's also a strategy, I think. I argued in this piece, and the point of the piece is that if you look at Iran's war aims at this point, they seem to be to have an actual stable Middle East after this is over. Whereas if you look at what the aims of Israel and even America are now that the kind of Venezuela clean version of regime change has failed, it's far from obvious that those plans entail a peaceful and stable Middle East. That was the point. That was the point I was making about that. Now, on this issue of So, the depletion of interceptors, you're saying you think the combined arsenal of American and Israeli anti-missile assets is getting, from their point of view, dangerously low already? I mean, I'm sure there's a certain amount of uncertainty in any of these estimates. There's a little guesswork, but is that what you're saying? Or is it just the Israeli portion of the arsenal? I mean, in the region, in other words, that can be marshaled on behalf of Israel.
Yeah, and I think those are largely indistinguishable. And I think one of the things that's gone on here is, of course, there is anger in the GCC state, in the GCC states, in the Gulf states, hosts to American bases, that Iran has not only attacked them at all, attacked those bases, but also as part of a mutual escalation when Israel and the US have escalated, has hit targets which one can less describe, and one in some instances cannot describe credibly as part of that American basing. So while that is true for the GCC states, I think the other thing that's going on is the GCC states are looking at this and saying, why the hell does America not take into account our interests and takes into account Israel's interests?
Right.
And why did America listen to Israel over this war rather than our concerns? And I think that's placed them on the horn of a dilemma. We can maybe come back to that. I say that in response to this particular question that you posed, because I'm suggesting that to the extent to which there is a depletion, those will first and foremost go to defending Israel, not to defending the Gulf. Now, it is the case, of course, that the Gulf is that much closer to Iran. It's that much more difficult to intercept with that kind of proximity. Israel is much further away. You've got more advanced warning.
It's easier to use drones, even relatively low-cost drones against the Gulf states because they're closer. I mean, there are drones that can reach Israel, but still.
Sure, and some of those have been used, but what we're seeing is, and that's part of this story, is that the Iranians have created another dilemma, which is throwing relatively low-grade, low-cost kit, which requires highly expensive, in most instances, interceptors to take those down. How far is it being depleted? I wouldn't be able to speak exactly to that. I think there is concern. Let's remember that in the 12-day war, it does seem, the one in June of 2025, it does seem that that was a real issue, that that was consequential in terms of how long this could continue. What we are being told is the extent to which those stocks could be not only replenished, but made more plentiful than they were last June, is limited in this time horizon. And so I think one of the questions is, have the US and Israel been sufficiently reckless in their homework, in their reading of what this would entail? Have they been drinking their own Kool-Aid, getting high on their own supply, buying into the notion that Iran's a paper tiger, this can be done relatively easily? If you bring in the firepower of America, when we remember how President Trump talked about this armada, he still every day talks about the greatest ever firepower. And yet, not only is Iran still able to respond, but I think there is, one should take seriously the idea, first of all, that Iran hasn't used all of its most effective, potentially destructive kit. And let's look at something else, which is the non-involvement thus far of the Houthis in Yemen. And we know they have significant capacity. Now, you could make the case, well, they're not involved because they've been sufficiently deterred or their stocks are low after all the strikes. I would lean much more into an explanation that says Iran is prepared for this to go longer. They had in mind drawing these parties into a war of attrition. Were they stupid enough to begin something like this? And at the appropriate time, the Houthis will join. And the fact that they're being kept in reserve, I think, speaks to the respective management on the parts of the different opposing parties of what they thought they were going into. And I think one of the biggest problems for the US is Iran has a strategy that is relatively coherent. It might be over-ambitious to think they can remove American bases from the region. But as you say, I think the goal here is to create an equilibrium of which they are a part in any day-after scenario. So Iran has a strategy. Israel has a strategy, I would argue, that it is very overambitious, and we can talk about what that strategy is, because I think it's about implosion, collapse, chaos, fragmentation in Iran. It's not about some happy-clappy fantasy of regime change. So Israel has a strategy, but I think all of us are struggling to understand, and it's fair enough that we're struggling because there is such incoherence and incompetence at the highest levels of the government there in Washington, D.C. We are struggling to understand what is the American strategy. And it kind of jumps from one thing to another. And therefore, if you have other parties with a strategy, and if on the war coalition initiators side of the US and Israel, even if there is an asymmetry in power between America and Israel, if one of those parties, even if it's the smaller party, has a clear sense of what it wants to achieve and the other doesn't, then by default, this is Israel's war and Israel's war goals, unless and until America can define something for itself.
Yeah. And I think, and one point I made in this piece is that, you know, for Trump, the failure of what he was hoping for was this quick and easy Venezuela type regime change is a much bigger political problem than it is for Bibi Netanyahu. As you said, Netanyahu is happy to just keep degrading the capacity of the Iranian state and is really not particularly afraid of it just dissolving into chaos and civil war, because that would still be an Iran that was not a coherent state capable of marshaling concerted effort. I mean, I'm not so sure he shouldn't worry more about a country with nuclear material and a civil war going on, but whatever. I don't think he is particularly worried about that. So you're right. It's not clearly a miscalculation from his point of view at all. It clearly is a miscalculation from Trump's point of view. I have a question. You mentioned the Houthis.
Can I just double down on that?
Sure.
Just very briefly, Bob. So let me add to that. Netanyahu has a population, a political class, a political establishment that is four square behind this. The entirety of the Zionist political spectrum, so that's 110 of the 120 seats in Israel's parliament, are with this. The population is with this. They have been told for decades, eventually this will have to happen. They are actually cock-a-hoop that when this moment has come, they have a prime minister who can pull America, its president, its military into this war. So he does not have a domestic public opinion problem to manage. He does not have a domestic political parliamentary problem to manage economically. Remember, Israel went into October 7th with a 60% debt to GDP ratio. That's maybe closer to 70% now, but that would still be the envy of the US in terms of America's economic position. So yes, Israel is a lot closer. America is a long way away. But when you look at the economic political management of this, the US has a much, much bigger problem. And Israel is seeking to assert a certain message in the region. Part of that message is America does our bidding. Gulf, the Americans don't do your bidding. No one else. The Americans do our bidding. So he is trying to assert a message in the region, whereas the the message that America is trying to send globally is far from clear and is managing to piss off ally and adversary alike. Sorry for that interruption.
No, that's okay. Well, then there's a certain amount of convergence between the Israeli and Iranian messaging, because God knows the Iranians want to convince the Gulf states that America is not going to do their bidding. And for that reason, they should start to disassociate themselves from the U.S. Let me ask you something about the degree of support that Netanyahu has, which I gather is extensive. Let me preface it by just drilling down a little more on this idea that he's happy for just all hell to break loose in Iran. There is a distinction that has kind of come to my attention since I wrote that piece, which is that there is some, it's true that broadly speaking, in the Israeli national security establishment, there's more and more reconciliation to the idea that Israel's strategy should just be to degrade the capacity of nearby states and non-state actors that either are or could conceivably become adversaries. I mean, they even bombed Syria right after a regime took power that was, you know, by all appearances, going to be pretty Israel friendly. But they just wanted to wipe out the military hardware just in case. And that does seem to be something of a consensus view. But somebody pointed out that with Netanyahu, it's even a little more extreme. Like, in other words, there are people in the security establishment who say, yeah, just degrade the Iranian state. They would rather it not dissolve into full-scale civil war, whereas for Netanyahu, it's like, first of all, ongoing conflict is helping to keep him out of prison, I gather, and helping to keep him in power. So he is more reckless than a lot of people in the national security establishment. But there is in the national security establishment just reconciliation to this idea that, look, you got to keep, quote, mowing the lawn every once in a while. You got to wipe out, you know, the military and even state capacity of an Iran, of a Syria. You've got to every once in a while kill a bunch of people in Hamas and destroy a bunch of infrastructure. Same with Hezbollah. And that's now happening, of course, because after the supreme leader was killed, Hezbollah felt compelled to fire, I don't know, 20 missiles into Israel. So after all, the supreme leader is a religious leader of some significance in the Shia community, and Hezbollah is a religious organization. And Israel took advantage of the opportunity to, I don't know, they seem to be in the process of seizing a big chunk of Lebanon that they may never let go of, for all I know. Anyway, I wanted to add that kind of asterisk, that footnote. But I want to ask you on the extent of support for Netanyahu, because some of this is starting to take a little bit of a toll on people. You know, northern Israel, as a result of the war in Lebanon, now is, you know, hit periodically by missiles. Everybody eventually gets tired of running into shelters in response to sirens. But I gather, you know, the public opinion polls seem to show huge support for Netanyahu. And you know, Netanyahu invoked this word Amalek, however you pronounce it, in this context recently. In the Bible, Amalek, they are these people who have tormented Israel so persistently that God just says, commit genocide against them, kill every living being. And Netanyahu's invocation of that is a pretty extreme thing. He also did the same thing with respect to Hamas after October 7th, I think. And I guess my question is, how many people in Israel, I don't mean they believe that God literally wants them to commit genocide against Iran or Gaza, but how many people view the situation that extremely? In other words, to them, Iran is a just constant existential threat, and this is really the only way to deal with it. Does that seem to be to you to be like a majority view in Israel?
I would say yes. I would say that's what they've been told. They also now listen to an American president who's telling them that. They've also listened to Western leaders. If I can draw an analogy on the Palestinian front, Israelis have gotten used to being able to get away with anything with the Palestinians. So that impunity has fed their extremism. Now, you don't have a narrative widely spread that the Palestinians are an existential threat. They're trying to develop a nuclear weapon. But that's the narrative on Iran. And you today have an American president who says, if Israelis paused for a second to think about this, that an American president said, if it wasn't for Netanyahu and me, there'd probably be no more Israel. Mm-hmm. Sheesh, that's one heck of a frail, fragile, endangered space you're living in. I would say that for me is the biggest finger to Zionism that you could possibly raise. Like, if that is even halfway true, Zionism is a huge failure as an answer to the Jewish question of how do Jews best protect themselves, which I happen to believe is the case, that Zionism is a strategic, huge wrong step. But let me not go too far down that cul-de-sac for now.
I do want to ask you, was that always your view? I'm curious. I noticed you were in some student organization in college, or maybe president of it or something.
I was president of that.
No,
that's headquartered in Jerusalem. Received part of its budget from the World Zionist Organization. I ended up in a massive fight with the World Zionist Organization because the Palestinian who I invited to speak to our conference, Ahmed Tibi, was at the time, he's now a member of parliament, considered at the time a confidant of Arafat, and I had my funding withdrawn, but that's a whole other world of joy. Well, but no, that was not my position all along.
When did you, what convinced you that Zionism had been... it just wasn't going to work out? Or when did you come to believe that?
I think accumulated lived experience that actual existing Zionism as practiced in the very real state of Israel across more than three quarters of a century now was antithetical to living in peace with the region, with our neighbors, with the Palestinians, and that if you were going to go further and further down this trajectory of being a Sparta, being a perpetual warlike nation, endangering yourself, I would say, making yourself unabsorbable in this region. And now what we really see, I think, is how much of a danger that then poses to Jewish communities everywhere. Then not only is this a huge problem for Palestinians, but I think this is a problem for the Jewish people collectively. I mean, when you have the likes of the Greenblatt, the head of the ADL, going out on TV now saying, it's anti-Semitic to suggest that, the Jewish state started this war. Well, factually, what the F do you think happened there, Mr. Head of ADL? So anyway, I think this is extremely dangerous. By the way, and this is part of the problem as well, as an act of statecraft, in terms of the narrow self-interest of the state of Israel, to play fast and loose with anti-Semitism, to instrumentalize Jewish communities, to encourage them to go out and shill for your genocidal policies, to actually encourage anti-Semitism, and then to say, hey, there's lots of anti-Semitism, that's the problem. The problem isn't our occupation, our apartheid, our ethnic cleansing. The problem is anti-Semitism. That's an obvious place for you to go to if you're the state of Israel that's trying to defend your narrow interest. I think the gap between that and collective global Jewish well-being could not be greater. And so I think that this project has become the most palpable danger to Jewish well-being, which means, by the way, that when I think about the future there, it's not that I'm saying, get rid of the Jewish Israelis. I'm actually saying if we want to think in terms of what is the best future for Jewish Israelis, what is the most secure, safe future for Jewish Israelis, then I would argue it is not to live in and to be the conveyors of an ethno-supremacist state project. And therefore, what we have to be able to prove is that you will actually live more securely if you drop this ethno-nationalist project of running a regime of supremacy for your own people. That's coming back, if I may, circle back to where we were before that. Mm-hmm. So there is very significant traction in the Israeli Jewish population for this war, for the idea that Iran poses this kind of threat. But, and here I want to challenge something you said, thus far, that does not translate into a significant uptick or any uptick so far in the polls, surprisingly, it may change, for Benjamin Netanyahu himself. So Netanyahu, as you reminded everyone, faces these court cases. It's true that the court cases kicked way into the long grass. He was having to appear regularly, was having to come up to for excuses why he wasn't going to court. That obviously he doesn't have to do. That's a short-term thing. The pressure is on the Israeli president, by the American president as well, to offer this, to grant this pardon. Netanyahu is managing his coalition a lot easier. And you would have thought that this could help him in the election. And it may still help him in the election. And we may look back and say this was the most expensive election campaign in world history, kicking energy prices where they are just to back Netanyahu's election campaign. Thus far, it's not playing out that way. One other thing to your earlier footnote, if I may, because you suggested this this counterpoint between Netanyahu, where what he is trying to achieve, and the security establishment. And I think that gap is smaller than traditionally we have considered it to be. So it's true that you now have, I mean, as in any war, right? You have the military officials saying, this is going swimmingly, how fantastically we're doing, no question. You increasingly see in the Israeli media anonymous background briefings by security officials saying, maybe we underestimated Iranian resilience. Maybe we set the bar for what we were trying to achieve here too high. This is already very, very significant. We've degraded in this way. Let's carry on degrading. By the way, also, maybe we underestimated Hezbollah. Opening another parenthetical. Hello, this is coming from the same military who obliterated Gaza. Absolute carnage and still didn't defeat Hamas. So you are having those briefings, but I think the security establishment, significant elements thereof are much more politically aligned with the radical extreme agenda of Netanyahu and his political leadership, because they are increasingly cut from the same cloth. Because a generation ago, the religious nationalist community said, after the withdrawal from Gaza in 2005, they said, we have made some really basic mistakes. One of them is we didn't put our people in the highest echelons. We didn't encourage our people to sign up to serve in the military. And you've seen a whole generation of religious nationalists go through officers' training course, sign up, work their way through the military. And today, the head of Central Command, which oversees West Bank, the head of the Shin Bet, and other people in top positions increasingly come from that social sector and with that ideology. And in that respect, this notion that Israel is trying to establish itself as a hard power hegemon, is trying to establish regional military domination, is much more widespread than I think is understood on the outside. And that is a project of extreme overreach, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to have its hands full at the moment. This war in Lebanon is no small thing. And I don't know if you're right that eventually there will be overreach. I guess they've pretty much gotten away with it so far. Of course, they may have to reckon with lessening support from the U.S. As time wears on. And I think to some extent they are assuming as much, actually, and aiming to become more self-sufficient militarily and so on. But we'll see about that. So what are the implications for the mindset you've just described for how this thing might end? So as I was saying, I'd argued in this piece that, you know, Iran doesn't want to get attacked again. Obviously, you know, Israel can do this to Iran, especially with American support, because Israel has pretty considerable military superiority. They can keep attacking them. Iran does not want it to happen anymore. And that's why you hear increasingly that Iran isn't just looking for a ceasefire. They are looking for some kind of long-term arrangement that will insulate them from future attacks. And here, the Gulf states align with them precisely because Iran has been attacking the Gulf states, right? I mean, Iran is sending the message, look, so long as this regime is intact, unless you take us down, when Israel attacks, we're going to make everybody in the region regret it and seriously mess up your business models and maybe mess up the world economy. And that, you know, in a strictly rational game theoretical sense, gives the Gulf states and really the U.S., if one thought rationally about U.S. foreign policy, not that I want to suggest anything that radical, but it would give them all an interest in establishing some kind of stable structure in the Middle East after this. So this is indeed the last war for a long time on this scale, and certainly the last one involving Iran. But do you see any, there are all kinds of problems with that. I mean, first of all, Gulf states are pissed off at Iran. On the other hand, they're pissed off at the U.S. and Israel. So they got to do business with somebody. Also, you know, Israel doesn't, my assumption is Israel doesn't really want to be that kind of constraint of a long-term security structure because they want to be able to repeatedly degrade the capacity of surrounding states and non-state actors, certainly including Iran. And then there's a problem that, you know, why would the Gulf states trust Trump? Like if he makes some guarantee, like, okay, I won't let Israel attack again. Nobody's going to believe that. So in light of all this, what are the chances for any peace near term that isn't just a prelude to likely war before terribly long after that? Or do you not even have such a hope?
Well, I mean, I think it's really hard, as you said, particularly in a Trumpian reality in which we live, to see that. So one outcome that apparently Israel is pursuing is the implosions and the beginning of the dismantling of the Iranian state. However, that's an outcome of chaos. Israel would look at that and say, well, that's a chaos that's confined to a place quite far away from us. To the extent to which it washes over, well, we've got our territorial depth. We've established a buffer zone in Syria. We're in the process, very possibly, of establishing another significant buffer zone in Lebanon. Remember, Israel occupied southern Lebanon for 18 years from 82 to 2000. We control the Palestinian territory. So that chaos is going to spill over into the Gulf, into Turkey, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, elsewhere. But it's not that much going to impact us, would be the case. And they would probably take that to the next level and actually say, in this scenario, we are probably the best bet for the Gulf. The Gulf, if the UAE has already done what they've done, it's not just an Abraham Accord signature on a piece of paper. It's a deep relationship, multiply layered, especially in terms of security. And Israel would say, well, the rest of you, you know, you're right. The American guarantee isn't that great, maybe, but you add us to the guarantee and it looks a whole lot different. So get on board with the project. By the way, part of getting on board with the project means shut up and let us finish the job with the Palestinians. That's an extremely unattractive offer in most respects to states who know that their own publics will be deeply uncomfortable with that. So it drives that wedge and who themselves don't want to trust
you, that. Is that really true? You hear that a lot, that the Arab leaders are, they don't give a shit about the Palestinians, but they do, you know, the Arab street, as they say, does care about the Palestinians, and that constrains the leaders because, although, yes, they may be autocrats, as we all know, autocrats worry a hell of a lot about public approval precisely because their rule, you know, isn't legitimated in the way it is in a democracy. And so they're kind of insecure. But is that true? You know, and if so, why have the Abraham Accords gotten as much traction as they've gotten? You know, you've got the UAN and I guess the UAE and I guess Bahrain have recognized Israel, I think. And Saudi Arabia clearly would kind of like to if Israel would just quit making it, you know, hard, among other ways, in this way, you know, with respect to the Palestinians. If Bibi could pretend he likes the idea of a two-state solution or something, that would help. But, and I'm sorry, I definitely want you to continue with your train of thought, but is it really true that there is ongoing public pressure in the Arab states in support of the Palestinians, and that is a real constraint on the leaders?
So I think that there is certainly a counter trend, which is, can't we just get on with doing our own thing? The Palestinians haven't done a great job of standing up for themselves. But every time Israel acts with such egregious cruelty, and those images fill the social media space, I think it does cause leaders, some of whom I think do see this as a cause that that they care about. Others may be much more keen for it to go away, but it makes them draw the conclusion that this is a destabilizing, radicalizing thing that impacts their own society. And of course, Israel continuously pokes and puts fuel on the fire by having spokespeople, by having government officials, by having very senior ministers, as well as just, you know, average soldiers who post things that are so gratuitously anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian, racist, are so Islamophobic. So the more Israel surrounds this with the trappings of a holy war, and this is a language that we're now seeing seeping into the American side of things, the American military. We've seen a lot of that, a Judeo Hegseth, or a Judeo-Christian, Hegseth, a holy war. That really reinforces this particular equation. So one outcome is that there is, which is not where we seem to be heading at the moment, and as you say, it's not an outcome for stability, but it's the outcome where the Iran is unable to hold things together, and then you've got another Iraq-style chaos. Like I say, that's not where we seem to be at the moment. When Israel, you know, when what there was, now it's died down a fair bit. It may rise again if this continues. This idea that the Kurds would be supported from the outside, maybe you'd create a liberated Kurdish zone, ethnically, geographically concentrated inside Iran. Maybe it's not Kurds, maybe it's Baluchi. But this was the idea of the fragmentation of the state. So that's one scenario. Excuse me. The other scenario is, they have to cut their losses. That this becomes too economically, politically onerous for the US. Israel would then say, well, look, we did a fantastic job of degrading. Maybe we didn't get everything, but I think they'd see this as a win anyway. What does the post-cutting your losses stability of the region and of the sub-region, Iran and the Gulf, look like? Very likely Israel will continue with what it's doing in Lebanon, for instance. But what strategic reorientation do we then see? As you say, Iran would look at this and say, well, now we have to create a regional security architecture that is not premised on you hosting American bases. I don't think those kinds of things kick in immediately afterwards. And as you say, I don't think you've got an America that's capable of responding, let's create a low bar, in a thoughtful way to that scenario. So if this comes to a close, I think we are still facing a period of quite lengthy and gradual reorientation, including the Gulf states asking themselves, is the existing security umbrella working for us? But how can we now work with the Iranians after what's happened? What is our best bet? Can we come together? Now, the bet that Israel is placing is that the Arab states will be unable to sufficiently work together. They will sufficiently pursue their own interests. They will not be able to adopt an approach that can contain or deter Israel. That has worked for Israel so far. You have nascent things that suggest that might change. But that's one of the things that we're going to see play out. I would maybe just add this additional thought, which everything else we've speculated on can still hold true, even if this is not the case. But I find it hard, Bob, to believe that Netanyahu went into this without anticipating that this would do further damage to Israel's reputation and image in the US. He follows these things. He knows where mm-hmm. public opinion is going. And he knows that he went out on a limb to make this war happen, and that even without Rubio's confirmation that this was a war initiated by Israel, that's why America had no choice, because Israel was going to do this, that was the perception. Now, if I'm right, and that Netanyahu knew this would be one of the consequences, one of the predictable consequences, then one of two things is going on here. Either Netanyahu, which is very possible the first one, which is Netanyahu is supremely confident in the ability of the lobby, independent expenditure campaigns, supportive media, the Ellison family buying everything, the Barry Weisses, the Jake Tappers, the purchase of American TikTok, of Warner Brothers Discovery, CBS, CNN, the weaponization of accusations of anti-Semitism, et cetera, et cetera. That at the end of the day, this is a blip and he can manage it. That's one option. But mm-hmm. I think there's another option. It may be that Netanyahu is looking at this and saying, you know what? We're going to dominate this region and we may not win back public opinion in America. And America is not the America it was. We're moving mm-hmm. towards a multipolar world. Let's use American power while it's still available to us. And let's use right. it in the most dramatic, devastating, game-changing way. If this accelerates American decline, if this accelerates Israeli unpopularity, so be it. This is our one and done. If we can remove this, then everyone will just have to gravitate towards our orbit as the unchallenged dominant power in the region. And then we can set up a regional axis with Ethiopia, India, Greece, with the Gulf states. I don't think that's going to work out, I as for all the reasons we've discussed already. But I at least think it's conceivable that that was part of the calculation in what's going on.
Yeah, I think if he sees which way the wind is blowing, you know, declining support for Israel that is partly, you know, kind of, you might say, demographically driven. In other words, young.
Yeah.
Center and left of center people, including young Jews, are less and less sympathetic to the idea of giving Israel military support. Plus, he's got a one-time opportunity in a guy as frankly stupid as Donald Trump. I mean, Trump.
Exactly.
I cannot imagine someone easier to manipulate than Trump. I mean, it's just like, you know, you just appeal to his vanity, and he doesn't understand the world well enough to see how implausible your scheme for your purported scheme for getting him the Nobel Prize or whatever he was, you know, whatever he was told is, and he does it. So it makes sense to me that they figured let's use the American alliance while it's still usable on this scale. That doesn't mean mm-hmm. the relationship's going to yes. end next year, but in terms exactly. of getting a president to join in a war. From the beginning, not like in June, which, by the way, that was a first in itself, that the U.S. would join Israel in a war like that. But even that was kind of a punctuation mark at the end, American bombing at the end that ended the whole thing. This is different, okay? He has brought the entire force of the U.S. military to bear on Iran from the beginning of this war. And I think he's right. You're not going to get another chance like this, dude. I mean, especially now. But... So that makes sense to me. So listen, Daniel, as you know, what I do with these things is we have a long conversation in public, which we've had. Then we go into what's called overtime. It's available to paid subscribers of Non-Zero Newsletter. I encourage everyone to become one. There's a link in the show notes. And I want to follow up on when we get into overtime on this question of what is foreseeable, you know, once this war ends, and what would and wouldn't kind of constitute a vindication of the Israeli strategy we just described, if that's what it is. But first, I want to give you an opportunity to tell people anything you want about where they can find your work or the work of your organization or anything else you recommend. I haven't seen you on Twitter much. Am I just missing your stuff? Are you, do you not do Twitter much?
No, the only place you can relatively regularly go is I have started a Substack. So I'll give a shout out to my own Substack, which is in my name.
Absolutely.
And yeah, so.
So it's Daniel Levy. They should Google Daniel Levy and Substack should get him to your newsletter.
They should, exactly.
Okay. All right. Well. Thanks. And I know, Daniel, you're feeling a little under the weather. I really appreciate you sticking around for overtime. And should you pass out, that will be the end of overtime. And in fact, should you even feel like you might, you'll be excused. I really appreciate you sticking around. I appreciate everyone who has listened or watched this far, whether or not they're going to follow us into overtime. But I certainly hope they will. And we're heading into overtime.